Hi, everyone. It's Brian Kilmeade here. Are you tired of those uncomfortable dress shirts, especially when they bunch up under a sweater? If so, then you must check out Collars & Co., makers of the Dress Collar Polo. Listen up. These shirts are four-way stretch, buttery soft polos with firm dress collars on them, so they give you the dress shirt look, but extremely comfortable polo feel. You can wear them with anything, under a sweater, with a blazer, or by themselves as an elevated polo. They work for any occasion. These polos are perfect, whether it's in the office, on a golf course or a night out. Collars & Co. is exploding and have gone viral on social media thanks to the $1 million investment they received on Shark Tank from Mark Cuban and Peter Jones. You don't have to worry about collars that flop down and spread out. They stay firm and sharp all day. It's an amazing array of sweaters, quarter zips, pants, and outerwear. If you're looking for the performance dress shirt or polo that looks great all day, check out collarsandco.com. Use promo code Brian for 15% off of any purchase of $100 or more. That's promo code Brian.
From the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show, Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Brian Kilmeade here from 48th and 6th in Midtown Manhattan. But around the country, around the world, we hope people are listening on the bases and with our enemies as well as our allies. Today's got a lot going on. We just got job numbers in. They are great numbers. 130,000 jobs added. They thought they would be about 60. Unemployment drops from 4.4 to 4.3. How does the market feel about it? It's up 257 points. So the market's responding. Wages have gone up. I just talked to Kevin O'Leary, Mr. Wonderful. Wages are in a good place. He goes, these numbers are fantastic. Scott Bessin says it's translating from Wall Street to Main Street. That is indeed the goal. The one thing they got to worry about is health care and housing. I guess there's more than that. You got to get prices down. We don't know where inflation numbers are, roughly 2.7%. Brett Baer standing by, so let's get to the big three.
Number three.
Mr. Lyons, do you consider yourself a religious man?
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, yes. Okay, well, how do you think Judgment Day will work for you with so much blood on your hands?
I'm not going to entertain that question.
Oh, okay, of course not. Do you think you're going to hell, Mr. Lyons?
I'm not
going to
entertain.
Of course not.
But LaMonica MacGyver, who's asking that question, the congresswoman, might be going to jail. We know that she tried to bull rush away into a facility, a ICE facility, and now she's been indicted for it. Embarrassing and aggravating. Dems continue to disparage and attack ICE and anyone associated with it, as you just heard, while not acknowledging the thousands of criminals they've taken off the street and their role in the violence perpetrated against them. We have the latest with a focus on Minneapolis.
Number two.
The key at the end of the day is no nuclear enrichment, no more ballistic missile or drone activity, and no more money going to their proxies. And Iran's never going to agree to that, and that's why I think the president needs to take his moment and make this a legacy-defining moment.
Nikki Haley on with Brett Baer last night, talking about Iran, and the governor of South Carolina couldn't be more right. Countdown to takedown. My hope is we take out this Iran government as they've begun assassinating would-be protesters in their hospital beds. Also, throwing 207 in jail and killing any other suspects. As BB comes to town to talk tactics with 47.
Number one.
There's a lot with that video, for sure. There's a lot of identifying features that people are going to key on. The backpack, his clothes, his walk. So you want this video out there because that's how this is going to move forward.
And they got video, doorbell video. You've probably seen the stills. You've seen the video. And we actually had a suspect pulled over in his car. And after questioning, they've let him go. All we know is his first name is Carlos. After being pulled over, he did talk to the press. Brett Baer, chief political anchor for Fox News, anchor a special report. Been all over this story, too. He's got his podcast that's out there, as well as the author of To Rescue the American Spirit, Teddy Roosevelt and the Birth of a Superpower. Brett, this story was moving a lot. I watched your show back this morning, and I felt after watching your show, knowing that things didn't break with the suspect, when you were done, didn't you feel as though they were going to get the guy before the night was out?
It seemed, yeah, Brian, I did feel like it was moving, and they had some good intel, and they were, you know, moving assets, and our people on the ground kept on saying that they were hearing off the record that, you know, something's coming. So, you know, we'll see where this goes. They clearly have a lot more info than they've had in recent days, but a little disappointing that it didn't all come to fruition last night.
And I'm sure you're, I'm sure everybody else is disappointed. Is it your understanding that they got this video out pretty quickly to the public, or do you think they held it for a while?
I understand that, or at least Kash Patel has said, that they, it took them a long time to get it through the companies. I think they worked with Google specifically, and this was not something that had been recorded. This was deep into the device itself, and it had to be retrieved. Interesting, big picture is that, you know, you don't think about that, that if it's not on, that it's still, the images are still there. That's something, a whole different thing we can talk about sometime. But they got it out as fast as they could. I think they showed the family members individually before they put it out publicly.
So I was looking at this. They say Google probably got this out in one of three ways. The feds could have gotten a search warrant and said, listen, we need you to go through this. Number two, the family could have authorized the tech giant to conduct this search. Or number three, Google could have voluntarily opted and said, hey, listen, we tracked it down and here's what we got. We don't know yet which one it is because they worry about long-term sales, which you just referred to, is a worry people have. Hey, I'm not bringing Alexa into my house because they think it listens to me all the time. You know, I want to shut off my Google camera, but am I really shutting it off? Now they say you got to put tape over it. But I'm always struck, and I know we've been over this to a degree, but I want to bring it up to the audience who might have missed it. So this guy walks up, we think it's a guy, to the camera. Brett, he looks at the camera and says, I got to block that. So he goes and gets some branches from a little shrub, as if he's going to defy gravity, and put it against the camera. Number one, he didn't think of it. Number two, how relaxed he is. And number three, is that really the idea you have to block the camera? Do you not realize you are walking up to a camera on camera? Did that strike you as just idiotic?
Yes, except I think that the Wi-Fi connection had been cut prior to that. And maybe their thought process was that this was already cut off to recording. So now you're just going to figure out how to cover it, but realize that you didn't think about that walking up to it. That's what I thought. But the fact that there wasn't a plan for the camera itself, it was a little bizarre. The whole thing was bizarre. And, that, you know, how that person is holding the gun in the holster that looks weird. You know, I think that there's a lot that can be gleaned from that video. Hopefully, it's going to lead them to something. Someone somewhere is going to have a tip.
Talking to Brett Baer, of course. So, Brett, you had Nikki Haley on last night. I'm just curious, did you seek her out, or did she come after you and said, I want to talk about this? Because I know she's got such an affinity and instinct for foreign policy, and the Iran situation is really coming to a head.
Yeah, I sought her out. I thought she hadn't done an interview in a long, long time, and I figured this would be a good time as far as especially international policy, but also turning to, you know, ahead of the midterms and what she thinks.
If there's a Republican president after Trump, I would love to see her Secretary of State if she doesn't run herself. But I love this comment, cut 11.
The key at the end of the day is no nuclear enrichment, no more ballistic missile or drone activity. Making sure the Iranian people finally have the freedom that they deserve and no more money going to their proxies. And Iran's never going to agree to that. And that's why I think the president needs to take his moment and make this a legacy defining moment.
And I think the president might see it that way. But I think I know kind of indirectly that he's really concerned about casualties because a desperate Iran does know where our vulnerabilities are to a degree, even with some air defense in theater. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I think that part of the delay here from where we thought it was going to all come together and happen was that Israel was not stocked with Patriot and other missile batteries to protect them. And there are others that had some concerns about, you know, defending against against Iran's missiles. So I think over time they've been restocked, and obviously more of the U.S. military, U.S. naval assets have been put in the region. If I had to guess, this falls apart, the negotiations, and that something happens. But you know, you know, the question is what comes next? What's on the ground? Who takes over? How does that transition happen? And I don't think we as a country have an appetite to get involved in that part of it.
And have we got somebody that we could deal with that might be, you know, if the IRGC is devastated and the Ayatollah is obliterated, who would be the Delcy Rodriguez to hold fort? Hold it together. He does not believe that Pahlavi is the person right now. That'll be something for him to work out with the Iranian people. But is there a Rouhani, the so-called moderate president from a few years back? Is there anybody out there? And if we've identified him, it seems as though Iran has identified him and is already doing some mass arrests.
Right, exactly. I would assume that the CIA, involved with Mossad, has gamed that out. But you know, it's a closed loop at the top in Iran, and unlike Venezuela, I think it's a lot tougher nut to crack once you get to that point. But you know, again, if I was to put money on it today, just knowing what I know, I think something happens when the negotiation falls apart.
So here's what General Keane said about the meeting today with Netanyahu and Trump, who have already done significant things together. Cut 17.
And it's remarkable in a sense because it reminds me of Roosevelt and Churchill, when Churchill was dealing with the Nazis and we hadn't been in the war yet, and Roosevelt was supporting him and talking to him on a regular basis, not just providing physical and material support, but obviously also moral support and intellectual support to the endeavor that they're doing. So the two of them seem to be married at the hip here, and I think it's absolutely the right approach.
So that's true. I mean, they understand each other. They understand militarily what they're capable of. And Israel has me in awe of what they've been able to accomplish militarily over the last few years, especially how they penetrated inside Iran while the attack was going on in that country.
Yeah. And I mean, the fact that they knew where the leadership was, the fact that they, took out a lot of those places, you know, look at all that Israel has done. I mean, even taking out leaders months, you know, with plans that took months to happen. So, yeah, I think that there's going to be some kind of look at how that the going forward there. I'm curious to see the conversation, and I doubt we'll have total insight into it about Bibi Netanyahu and President Trump, about Netanyahu's political future and what he sees, you know, still facing some legal challenges in Israel.
Right. Just real quick, on the chance of a government shutdown and, of course, the fireworks yesterday on Capitol Hill, because ICE acting director Todd Lyons was there along with Rodney Scott. 21 is LaMonica McIver. She's the congresswoman from New Jersey who right now got herself in a lot of hot water for bull rushing her way into an ICE facility, which thankfully she didn't get in, but she has been indicted for. Listen to this exchange. Cut 21.
Mr. Lyons, do you consider yourself a religious man?
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, yes. Okay, well, how do you think Judgment Day will work for you with so much blood on your hands?
I'm not going to entertain that question.
Oh, okay, of course not. Do you think you're going to hell, Mr. Lyons?
I'm not
going to
entertain.
Of course not.
Gentlelady,
how many government...
The gentlelady will suspend. The gentlelady will suspend.
Chairman?
A gentlelady will suspend.
Your thoughts about that exchange?
It's crazy. You know, it's... Both sides of the aisle sometimes do, you know, crazy things in hearings to just get attention. And are you going to hell is not a question that elicits anything of substance from from the head of ICE. And I think that, you know, this is obviously a passionate issue. There's a lot of emotion here. But you're looking for facts. You're looking for stuff that advances the ball, not are you going to hell. and both parties are guilty of it. This time, Democrats, sensing political advantage, I think are going over their skis.
And just in reality, if Todd Lyons had his druthers, he's more in Tom Homan's camp than Kristi Noem's camp and Corey Lewandowski's camp. And same with Rodney Scott. They were both sidelined. So they're forced to defend policies that they weren't necessarily authoring, even though their title says they were. And I think almost everybody knows that.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's dysfunction inside DHS and how it's all been dealt with. And especially, you know, to ask those kinds of questions to somebody who maybe was not operationally as integral in some of that as they could have been.
Lastly, just before we let you go, Brett Baer, and get ready for your show tonight, the Dow's up 233 points, as I mentioned. It looks like the job numbers come in way over estimated. They added 130,000 jobs. Some said they predicted about 60,000 jobs. So the unemployment drops to 4.3%. When do you think some of these outstanding, we're over 50,510 right now. When do these numbers start resonating with the American people? I mean, that's the question. Trump thinks it's a PR problem. What do you think?
Well, I think some of it has to sink in. I will say that the revisions from 25 were not good overall, like the losses from last year. And but these numbers are much better than people projected. And I think, you know, if you listen to Secretary Bessent, it's a situation where they believe that the growth and the positivity is going to outdo some of the criticism that they're seeing. The question is, how do people feel about it? What do they feel at home? And that's what the midterms are going to all be about.
Hey, Brett, I don't know how much free time I'm going to have, but I'm going to be in town for the State of the Union address. A lot of people wonder if we hang out, if there's no camera or microphone. Think about your answer to that, because this is constantly the email and inquiries I get. So think about what you want to do. I'm going to be in your town for a couple of days.
All right. First of all, you should be on the panel.
Okay.
And second of all, maybe we could go get a beer. I don't know.
That'll be great. Well, one beer and we'll split it, because we've got to be sharp the next day.
All right.
Brett, we're going to see you tonight at 6 o'clock Eastern Time. Brett Baer, don't move.
Politics, current events, and news that affects you. Brian's got a lot more to say. Stay with Brian Kilmeade.
This is Ainsley Earhart. Thank you for joining me for the 52-episode podcast series, The Life of Jesus.
A listening experience that will provide hope, comfort, and understanding of the greatest story ever told. Listen and follow now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you listen to podcasts.
If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
The DHS bill, as you know, represents not only Border Patrol and ICE, but also FEMA and the Coast Guard and TSA, cybersecurity, a whole bunch of things that are really important to the American people. And these federal employees at TSA and other agencies shouldn't be held hostage by the Democrats potentially another government shutdown. So the best way to avoid that is to strike a deal.
Yeah, strike a deal. They have these 10 reforms that they want to see to ICE. And the Republicans go, no, we're not going to do that. There's some of them we'll talk to you about, but some of them are non-starters. But they're talking at each other, not with each other. And if you don't get this settled by Friday, DHS doesn't get funded. And what Senator Thune was running down is DHS is such a wide, sprawling division. You have TSA and, you know, air traffic control. All these people aren't going to get paid. But yet they worked at all the appropriations bills. They know exactly what they belong. And ICE is not going to be affected. The people that you want to affect have been funded until 2029. So you're not going to touch their budget unless you get in power and you want to do some type of rescission, which we just saw with Republicans. Not easy when Congress gives you money to just take it back. When we come back, Mike Markovsky joins us, president and CEO of the Jewish Institute for National Security of Americas. He's a leading Washington, D.C.-based policy and educational organization focused on U.S. defense. We're talking Iran, the Middle East, and the chances of a conflict, and that conflict spreading. What do you think is going to happen with Netanyahu today as he meets with President Trump? I got some ideas.
Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Do you think a deal with Iran with this current regime would ever really stick?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I know one thing. They want to make a deal. They wouldn't talk to anybody else, but they're talking to me. But, you know, it's a good question. A lot of people say no. And I would say that I'd rather make a deal. It's got to be a good deal. No nuclear weapons, no missiles, no this, no that, all the different things that you want. But some people worry that they've been very dishonest with us over the years, right? Very dishonest.
President's getting philosophical, very similar to when he was asked about Maduro. Well, we don't know. You know, he's got some choices to make. We'll see what he does. We'll see. And meanwhile, they were rehearsing plans to take him out of his bed, and they took him. Soleimani landed in Iraq. He was going to go up and meet with his militias and foment more terror. And they said, Mr. President, we could probably take him out now in his first term. And he took him out. El-Baghdadi got loose. Go kill him. They killed him. That's done. Hey, the nuclear programs has been exposed. They are in an all-out war with Israel. The U.S. at first said, yeah, we'll see what happens. It had nothing to do with us. The whole time we were planning in great detail and have been for about 20 years how we would take out their nuclear program. And they did it. And even Democrats say it was brilliant. And the Maduro capture was brilliant. They're blowing up the Houthis to the point where they allow the waterways to go free again, and they've not been bombing our ships or anybody else's ships. That's certainly significant. It sounds like the president knows there's no way Iran is going to say, you know what, I don't need to use that uranium anymore. Got plenty of oil. I'm tired of sending checks to Hezbollah and Hamas and those ballistic missiles. Let's just close up the plant. There's almost no chance that'll happen. Michael Murkowski joins us now, president and CEO of the Jewish Institute for National Security of America and a leading Washington, D.C. policy and educational organization focused on the U.S. defense and national security issues in the Middle East. So, Michael, welcome. First off, President Trump is meeting with Prime Minister Netanyahu today. I don't think this is just, hey, what have you been doing? How are you doing? How's your family? They're going to talk tactics and substance, aren't they?
Absolutely. Thank you for having me. Absolutely. It's notable that this is Netanyahu's seventh visit to meet with President Trump since President Trump was elected. They're talking concrete stuff. They're not here just to hang out.
Yeah, I mean, one is Hamas has said again, we are not giving up our weapons, and we're in phase two of the Gaza rebuild. Some things are going well. We have other people involved. We have the Board of Peace. We are working hard. I know they got this building with one floor is Americans, one floor is Israelis, others a representative from the region. So they're trying to get to the point where they can start rebuilding Gaza, but that's going to be an issue. But the main thing is on Iran. Why do you think the prime minister said to the president publicly about 3 weeks ago, not now, Mr. President?
Yeah. So look, first of all, I think President Trump deserves a lot of credit. He's the first president since the Islamic Revolution, which they just celebrated their 47th anniversary, which is not something the regime might be celebrating it. But most of the Iranian people and certainly most of what we used to call the free world certainly lament. And I think Trump deserves a lot of credit that he's the first president to publicly support the demonstrators. And there have been protesters against the regime over the decades. Obama and Biden ignored them. And President Trump said, look, you know, we support the people. And he warned the regime. So what this is about, really. So then he wanted to do something. And because I think President Trump is we've seen this many times, like with the hostages, he hates to see innocent people be killed or taken into tunnels and things like that and killed or oppressed. So he wanted to act. But I think the Israelis said, look, you know, if we're going to do this right, we need a little more time and we need to prepare. the Israelis and the United States needs to as well. And I think that's what we've seen. So now we have a lot, the United States has a lot more assets in the region. Israel's had time to prepare. So I think they're really focusing on coordinating what they're going to do if President Trump decides to attack.
We need, the president says, I'm thinking about bringing another aircraft carrier in. Do we need it?
I don't think so. I'm not here to second guess our military planners, so I'll defer to them. But and I think the U.S. approach generally is to be extra prepared. Israel's approach is to prepare, obviously, but sometimes Israel's used to, I think, reacting a little more quickly. I don't think we have to. You know, you don't know. Time will tell whether it was a ruse or it was really something we really need to do. But what it does suggest to me to bring all these assets is that we're not just talking about maybe like Midnight Hammer, which was a great thing where we brought the B-2s to finish off the nuclear program that the Israelis started doing in June. But we might be thinking about it, and it suggests possibly a little longer campaign by both countries.
Yeah, because they want to make sure these guys don't stay in power. I'm sure you guys know better than most that they are actually going after and killing all the protesters they can, including one whose ones are in the hospital. They are going to find them in the hospitals and are killing them. They arrested 207 people, and they've been executed over the last 3 weeks. And now they're just arresting other people where they torture them in prison. They will do anything to stay in power. They are remarkably unpopular with their own population who is not armed, and they still courageously continue to protest over the weekend, reportedly. And the president has said, we got your back. But of course, we didn't have assets in place. I just can't see a scenario where the president says, shake my hand, we got a deal. I think this ends in some type of military action. The question is, between the intelligence Israel has and we have we identified somebody we could work with the day after?
First of all, I completely agree with you. I don't think after everything that happened, as you correctly pointed out, I think it'd be a very hard for President Trump to just say, hey, I made a deal on their nuclear program and, you know, things are good and et cetera, et cetera. I think he knows that he can't, it'd be a tough thing for him to do after he, as you point out, his credibility, I think, is kind of on the line here to punish the regime for the slaughter of their people, for the mass slaughter of their people, and to do what we can, along with the Israelis, to help weaken the regime, to facilitate the Iranian people to bring it down. Excuse me. But it'll be ultimately the Iranian people that bring it down, but we could help weaken the regime. So about what you're asking, I think it's a tough thing. That's a tough thing to game. Because I think a lot of people believe it's a common view that even if you take out the supreme leader, you have the IRGC, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard forces that will take over. I think it's probably a little too early on that. And I think the key thing is you want to weaken the regime levers of power, including leaders of the forces like the Besiege and the IRGC and some of the military that are supporting the regime. And then just really kind of do what you can to help facilitate the people to bring it down.
Michael, for people that out there says, well, we don't want a war in the Middle East, and we should be focusing on China. We're not going to be able to focus on China like we should if Iran continues to foment violence and terror in the region, especially with our alliance with Israel. We're going to need a significant presence there and talk less about the economy, more about the military. If you want to really pivot to China, deal with this problem once and for all. It's been 40 years. The only thing consistent is they do everything possible to hurt our objectives and to kill our people.
Look, I agree. Actually, you could even argue that this is could be part of a pivot to China because the Iranian regime is maybe the Chinese closest friend in the Mideast. There's the Chinese are selling missile technology, all sorts of things to the Iranians. So actually, if you want to weaken the Chinese, you want to take care of the Iranians. And also, I think the Chinese and the Russians will see that if we don't address this issue, especially everything that the president said, you know, we have your back. We're on our way. We're locked and loaded. Things like that. I think if he doesn't do something, it will hurt our credibility, and therefore it will weaken ourselves with the Chinese and the Russians.
So let's talk about the Chinese. Let's talk about the Chinese in Ukraine. Yesterday, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov continued to explicitly blame the United States on February 10th for the lack of progress in ending Russia's war against Ukraine, and reinvoked the spring of 2022 Istanbul talks to justify Russia's rejection of Ukraine's meaningful security. They went on to say that Russia, that they think we are now the enemy of Russia. Lavrov, as you know, speaks for Putin pretty succinctly. He says he claimed the U.S. policy towards Russia under Trump are moving in the wrong direction. So, and this is exactly what Trump says. Actions rather than words demonstrate that the United States remains an adversary to Russia. Yes, Trump's always said he's taking a somewhat conciliatory tone with his words, but his actions and his latest move, telling India, stop buying Russian oil, and they are. They're going to start buying it from us. Russia looks at us as hostile. To me, that's the president saying, I don't need to get in your face to act against you.
Yeah, no, I couldn't help but smile when you repeat this, because I'm happy to hear in some ways that the Russian foreign minister is saying things like that. To me, that suggests the U.S. foreign policy is going in the correct way. It's obviously ludicrous accusation by Lavrov. The real problem here is the Russians. And I think once Trump deals with the Iran issue now, I think it'd be good for him, I think, to pivot and start putting even more pressure on the Russians with more, you know, tightening, preventing more of their oil exports. And that's the only way I think we have to come. We got to get to an end to this war, obviously. And I think one way to do it is the main way to do it is to put a lot more pressure on the Russians.
And by the way, if you think this is a Ukraine problem, yesterday NATO jets intercepted another Russian jet fighter right near the Baltic Sea. So they're trying to go into the hinge of the and breach the borders of almost every NATO nation. And we're seeing now that we're seeing reports that if the Russians were to invade, that the UK has 4 days worth of armaments, that they're incapable. The Germans are incapable of repelling any Russian military action. So there's a vulnerability of NATO. And I think that they should realize that Russia is not going away. But it would be great to see the president ratchet up the amount of arms, give them the tomahawks, and let the Russians know we're not backing away. So I appreciate it, Michael. Thanks so much for joining us.
All right. Thank you very much. Have a good day.
Yeah, we'll see what's next, and we'll continue to watch the BB Donald Trump meeting, and then if it results in questions. One of the reasons it won't is because this press is obsessed with the Epstein files, obsessed with ICE. And he'll be sitting there with the prime minister talking about a Middle East conflict. And I think there's only going to be like two questions about that. And then it just gets awkward and stupid. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show.
From breaking news to big name guests, Brian brings you insight you won't hear anywhere else. You're listening to the Brian Kilmeade Show. News, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
You think these numbers are crazy? This next one, these are bonkers. Okay, what are we talking about here? Americans rate the job market as bad or good. February 2025, equal share. Say fair or say bad or good. 42, 42. Look at this now. Over just a year's time, now the clear majority, 52%, up like a rocket, rated as bad compared to just 33% down to the basement who rated as good. So what we've seen is Americans rating the job market. It was an even split a year ago, and now the clear majority by a 19-point margin rated as bad rather than good. And that goes a long way to explain why Donald Trump's numbers on jobs and unemployment have fallen to the floor.
And the main reason is health care and housing. That's what, in fact, Kevin O'Leary just told me. He sat and listened to the testimony yesterday and these hearings. And that's what's the main focus of it. But what you're seeing is the job numbers go through the roof. The market go through the roof. Interest inflation has dropped from, as high as 9, now down to 2.7%. They want it down to 2. I get it. You have rates have dropped, but not as much as the president have wanted. It's around 5. So we'll see what happens. So the jobs number's good. And by the way, wages have matched the increase in opportunity. So the inflation has gone down. Wages have gone up and kept up with the growth. That's been the problem in years past. But for some reason, the president doesn't get that reflected in the numbers. Also, some of the investment that he's bringing back, much to the detriment and anger of our allies. He's all about bringing business back here. And by the way, some industries, like, for example, the car business and apparel business, say, we don't have anything. We can't build this all here. They're not ready yet. The infrastructure isn't here. And now there's huge tariffs on it. But they also bring in tariff revenue. It's up to the president. When people get those, I think the next big thing for Republicans is when people see the big, beautiful bill impact when it comes to all the write-offs that they have and the refunds that they're getting, so they'll have more money. I mean, you give people $500, $1,000, it's certainly going to help. There's some controversy in doing that. But there's no controversy in giving people back the money, their own money, I would think. But it's got to be frustrating for the president who says, I got a PR problem, and that's my issue. People don't understand how good it is. And now he's also working on energy. People also know this is a fact. Gas prices are going down and continuing to drop, and diesel prices are going down too. Scott Turner, HUD secretary, cut 35.
American people, from the Gen Z, the younger people, to the older people in our country, are talking about housing affordability. And the president has taken this very seriously. Myself, other leaders in this administration are taking this very seriously. The president has taken bold action, as you've seen, to prioritize American homeowners. He's mandating institutional investors, large institutional investors, from buying up single family homes. He's Director Pulte to buy $200 billion in mortgage-backed securities over at Fannie and Freddie. So as you can see, actions have been taken. More actions will be taken.
And with some of these trade deals are really going to begin to benefit. For example, 18% tariffs on India. We're back with a free trade deal with that booming democracy. In unequal but booming democracy. And it's the biggest one in the world, by the way, bigger than us. And then you have India, that's going to be good. The South Korea-Japan deal, that's going to be good, although people aren't optimistic that they'll actually buy American cars in Japan. Still, for the first time, they'll have that opportunity. And no one's really disputed this. I watched Scott Bessent over the weekend. He said China is living up to the framework of the trade deal as we worked it out when it comes to farmers. Now, farmers needed the subsidies. For a while, the Chinese stopped buying our soybeans and other products. They bought it and paid more money for it from Argentina. And now, according to this deal, we're back getting that going. Now we got to work on beef, and a lot has to do with nothing to do with the president, but the meat packers and the ranchers. That will help out with rural America. Also, the president's getting coal going, cutting regulation. These are the things that he hopes change what Harry Enten says on CNN. But there's one thing about him. He does not lie about the numbers. He comes out and will say it either way. Trump has not lost any support with MAGA. I find it almost comical. I like listening to the New York Times daily podcast. But every single time, every third day, it's like, has Donald Trump finally losing the MAGA base? Marjorie Taylor Greene is no longer. Has Donald Trump lost the MAGA base? Tom Massey, once the Epstein files out, have they lost the MAGA base? And the numbers don't move. What you want to focus on is independents and moderates. And when it comes to the ethnicity, continue to make gains in Hispanics. Those are legitimate concerns. The other one, don't worry about it.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, welcome to 48th and 6th in Midtown Manhattan. We got a big show coming your way right here in New York City, where they still have not figured out how to pick up the garbage and plow the snow. It is Senator Roger Marshall standing by, trying to find out if we're going to be shutting down the Department of Homeland Security or not. I'm not kidding. We have till Friday. And the bottom of the hour in studio, George P. Bush, the CEO of Pine Cove Strategies and the former land commissioner over in Texas. We'll see how what the next step is for him and his family. I know his cousin is actually running for governor in Maine, trying to get the Republican nomination. So before we get to Senator Roger Marshall, we're waiting on Pam Bondi. She's coming to Capitol Hill to talk about what else, the Epstein files. And of course, we'll have all these crazy accusations and all these the demands. But if you want to know what's important in this country, Epstein files, get to the bottom of it. But when you talk about things that really matter, it's not in the top 100. But that's all Democrats want because it's soap opera material. So let's get to the big three.
Number three.
Well, how do you think Judgment Day will work for you with so much blood on your hands?
I'm not going to entertain that question.
Oh, okay, of course not. Do you think you're going to hell, Mr. Lyons?
I'm not
going
to end.
Of course
that's
not.
That's the embarrassing New Jersey Congresswoman MacGyver, who's looking at an indictment for trying to storm into an ICE facility. Embarrassing and aggravating. Dems continue to disparage and attack ICE and anyone associated with them, while not acknowledging the thousands of criminals they've taken off the streets here illegally and their role in the violence perpetrated against them. We have the latest with a focus on Minneapolis.
Number two.
The key at the end of the day is no nuclear enrichment, no more ballistic missile or drone activity, and no more money going to their proxies. And Iran's never going to agree to that, and that's why I think the president needs to take his moment and make this a legacy-defining moment.
Countdown to takedown. My hope is we take out this Iranian government as they begin to assassinate would-be protesters in their hospital beds, arresting others, torturing them, and killing them. They'll do anything to stay in power. We're the only ones that could stop them. Netanyahu in town to talk tactics with Trump.
Number one.
There's a lot with that video, for sure. There's a lot of identifying features that people are going to key on. The backpack, his clothes, his walk. So you want this video out there because that's how this is going to move forward.
That is the former NYPD officer, Tom Smith. Talk about the Guthrie case, a major break. They got some video. They got some stills. They just don't have the guy, but they have over 10,000 leads. Hopefully they'll get to the bottom of Savannah Guthrie's mom. Meanwhile, Senator Marshall joins us now. Senator, welcome back.
Brian, great to be with you. And we've got the same snow problem here. They can't get it off the streets.
Yeah. We had a guy that also left the people on the streets, and 18 people died, of which are from hypothermia, because they don't want to clean up the homeless encampments, but they rather let people freeze to death. That shows the benevolence. And that is, it's a bigger story. I mean, that is the story of all of California, too.
Yeah, you know, this term collectivism, isn't that hit the mayor of New York's term? I think if this is what collectivism is, we want no part of it. We want competent people running our government. And by the way, we want a government that provides for our safety and security and make sure that there's law and order in the land as well.
Yeah, so let's talk about the chances of the DHS getting funded. Here's Chuck Schumer, Cut 20.
Today, the heads of ICE, Border Patrol, and other enforcement agencies testified in the House for the first time since the killing of Alex Preddy and Renee Good. However, today, the head of ICE refused to answer if Good and Preddy deserved to die. Refused to answer. And when asked if he would commit to unmasking ICE agents so they can be identified, he had a simple answer: no. Most Americans would be aghast that we should have secret police, unidentified police, roaming through our neighborhood.
Yeah, this is the guy that wanted everyone masked, including two-year-olds, athletes playing on open field soccer games. And now he says ICE and Border Patrol need to be unmasked. And that's part of the punch list that they want, and if they don't get it, they're going to shut down the government. Where's this going, Senator Marshall?
Well, I think that Chuck Schumer wants to shut the government down over this issue. It's the only issue he's really got out there that he can cling on to. We have the economy growing at 4 to 5%, a good jobs number today. Real wages are growing. So I think that they're clinging to something, and this is it. But I just want to emphasize that we, the Republican Party, that we are the party of secure borders, of safety and security, of law and order. Here's the Democrats, again, defunding the police for all practical purposes. He's negotiating through the press here. He's negotiating with his Twitter this morning as well. At the end of the day, this is a conversation between President Trump and Chuck Schumer, way around this situation right now. I still think we end up with a short-term CR, continuing resolution, to fund DHS here for a couple more weeks, because we're not close on the negotiation. We shouldn't give in. We cannot let yesterday's headlines dictate policy and what we should be doing long term.
Yeah, here's Todd Lyons yesterday defending the fact that his agents got to wear masks. They are being threatened every day. Cut 24.
In fiscal year 2025, death threats against ICE personnel increased more than 8,000%. Assaults on officers have skyrocketed over 1,400%. One officer in Minnesota had his finger bitten off by a protester, egged on by elected officials characterizing our officers as Gestapo or secret police. The families of personnel, ICE personnel, have been made to feel unsafe in their homes. I know this firsthand because my own family was targeted. But let me send a message to anyone who thinks they can intimidate us. You will fail.
So that's why, and he knows why. And if you want to maybe put numbers on the uniforms instead of names, maybe you could work on that, you know, if you want it. But there's masks for a reason. Nobody wants to wear a mask. It's very uncomfortable.
Yeah, and this is for real, Brian. Again, folks back home whose loved ones are working for ICE have been doxxed, and their loved ones are all across the country, but they're now having to hire private security to take their kids to school. And it just goes on and on and on. I don't feel safe out there anymore publicly announcing where I'm going to be. These same type of people show up, and they're unhinged, they're unstable. They're Trump derangement syndrome with now a psychosis where they're detached from reality. So I don't know. I think it would be, you cannot unmask ICE agents right now. But what they could do is eliminate sanctuary cities, which I think is the true root of the problem. If these sanctuary cities were cooperating with ICE, you could do this. It would take two people to do what we're sending 40 people to do right now, 40 ICE agents.
But you do what? Are you happy with Tom Homan's tactics? I think he's going to be scaling down again, maybe tomorrow. Are you happy with the way things are working out?
I think we're going in the right direction. The tactics that are going to work in a sanctuary state are going to be different how they work in Kansas or Texas as well. And just remind your listeners, Barack Obama deports 3 million people with the same rules for ICE that we have engaged right now, and everything went just fine. I think the problem is sanctuary cities. I don't think that the problem is ICE right now. And all that being said, I do think that ICE can turn the temperature down in Minneapolis. I think they are turning the temperature down, but we need to stay true to our cause. There are hundreds of thousands of violent, illegal, criminal aliens out there that need to be removed.
So now here we are in 2026. They said if you don't get the subsidies reinstated to those who receive Obamacare, you guys going to be in a political firestorm. You're a doctor. Doctor, how is it going? To me, we haven't figured out a way to help people out with their huge deductibles and rates.
Yeah, so the true problem is the cost of health care for everybody, not just the 25 million people that were on Obamacare, a third of which are don't even know they're on, and that's the cheating scandal going on as well. So certainly that's my upfront. I wake up every morning, how can we bring the cost of health care down? Our lead bill is a price tag bill, first, which would force every health care provider to show their prices up front, encourage competition wherever we can. As well, we need to proceed to a reconciliation bill to do this because the Democrats aren't going to allow us to do anything. They hate Donald Trump so much. If we had a bill that would cure cancer, the Democrats would not vote for it if they thought it could get to Donald Trump's desk.
And I'll give you an example, the Voting Act. You have 70% of the country plus who want to have a voter ID because they don't want their vote nullified. That means all ethnic groups, 70%. But yet they say that this is Jim Crow 2.0. And here's the president yesterday, that cut 31, because I think they're in the House, they're going to debate the SAVE Act, which includes that, cut 31.
You have a thing called Save America Act. Save America Act. And Schumer's going to say, I oppose it. How do you oppose Save America? So this is simply on voting. Voter ID. We want a statement that you are a citizen of America. I think that's a reasonable thing to ask. And no mail-in ballots, which are very corrupt. No country in the world is doing mail-in ballots, or especially the way we do them. I mean, they send them all over the place. Nobody knows. It's totally corrupt. No country in the world does what we do.
So where is that at? The SAVE Act, you think it'll get through the House?
I think some version of it's going to get through the House. We're on the Senate side. We're trying to tweak it where we can actually get 60 votes. But I think here the important issue to me is that safe and secure elections are the bedrock of our republic. If we don't have safe, secure elections, then like you pointed out, your vote doesn't even count. So there is so much ability to cheat right now. When you have let elections go on for months at a time, mail-in ballots, there is the opportunity for cheating to occur. I think it's very reasonable that we would acquire some type of proof of citizenship when you register to vote. We all have to do that when we get our driver's license. And then when you're voting, to have an ID that's consistent with how you registered as well. To me, it's common sense. I would love to go to one day of voting. Look, I think this is an 80-20 issue again, just like safety and security is. This is an 80-20 issue. Let's make the Democrats in the Senate vote on this. Let's make them, you know, make them put their cards on the table and say, look, they're not interested in safe and secure election, despite 70% of Democrats support this.
Senator, are you worried about the Senate in the midterms?
I don't think I'm worried. I think that we can't take anything for granted. We should win. But we do need to kind of turn the tide here. We need to make sure that people realize that the economy is good, but at the same time acknowledge that there's a two-lane economy right now. There's a fast lane. People over the age of 50, they bought a house 20 years ago. They've been contributing to their retirement fund. I think they're sitting good, but there's a huge group of people under the age of 40 that, because of 4 years of Joe Biden inflation, find that life, that they can't live their American dream. And we need to focus on how do we bring the cost of housing down, health insurance we talked about already, child care, property insurance. So there are some real cost of living issues out there that we need to address to help bring this majority back to the United States Senate in November.
Yeah, the market's down 100 points, but it was up 500 when I started this hour. 130,000 jobs ended. It was supposed to at 60, so that's good news. So even though the GDP is up, the market is up. You see gas prices down. Here's what the polls say, and I'll tap into CNN for this. Cut 36.
These numbers, as John and I were discussing just before this segment, absolutely crazy in how the American people have totally turned on Donald Trump. Take a look here. Trump's net approval rating on jobs and employment. In January 2025, look at that. Overall, plus 9 points. Hey, that's pretty good. But down he goes, minus 13 points overall. But you think that's nuts? Take a look at the independents. They go from plus 7 way, way, way down off the screen to minus 30 points. That's a 37-point drop in the net approval for Donald Trump among independents on the issue of jobs and employment.
So the president says he has a PR problem. Senator Marshall, what do you think?
Well, I think that, yeah, perception's reality, and Republicans need to acknowledge that there is indeed this two-speed highway system going right now when it comes to the economy. There's a large group of people that are struggling right now due to 4 years of inflation from Joe Biden, and we need to acknowledge that 90% of the media is out there just thrashing people, telling them how miserable life is, despite all those good numbers you just talked about, 4 to 5% GDP. Who could have ever thunk of that? And by the way, the jobs we're adding are not government jobs, which I think distract from the economy. They're not part-time jobs. We're adding real jobs. But regardless, we have until November to weed this out. And by the way, the only thing lower, only thing worse than President Trump's numbers are Democrat numbers, right? So these people are going to come home, but we've got to deliver for them as well and bring the cost of living, help start to bring that cost of living down. We're making progress. Again, real wages are up, but we still have 4 years of Bidenflation to deal with.
Right. So 2.7% right now, Senator Marshall. So lastly, you feel as though we'll get a CR, so everyone go to the Munich Security Conference.
Lordy. Yeah. I hate to be, that's the reason that we're going to do a CR. I think we got problems here at home we need to take care of. I think that the Republicans need to go back and talk more about the working families tax cuts bill. I think that every American is going to get on average $1,000 more of a refund from the IRS. So I think we need to be out there talking about it. The Munich security system, I think it's just over. They're just brown nosing each other. I don't have much use for it. But you're right. It's one of the reasons the Democrats want to get out of here.
All right, Senator Roger Marshall, thanks so much. And my exit question to you is just on Iran. Have you been briefed at all about what our options are over there, and what you feel as we should be doing?
Nothing. I would guess they're on the appropriate committees. There's briefings going on, but nothing for all the Senate. I think we need to measure twice and cut once here. We need to bring some support from Saudi and some of the other nations over there as well. And I think we're doing that. I think we're being very measured here.
Senator Roger Marshall, thanks so much. Appreciate it. When we come back, we'll be able to squeeze in some calls. And then welcome to the studio, George P. Bush. You're listening to the Brian Kilmeade Show.
It's Brian Kilmeade. fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, we're back in a couple of minutes, so let's go to the phones. Don, you're in New York City. Don, what's on your mind?
Yes, I have a question about this Save America Act and the voter ID.
Mm-hmm.
I see it very flawed.
What don't you like about it?
It is seriously flawed.
What don't you like about it?
It is legal in any state of the United States to issue a driver's license or an ID to an illegal immigrant.
True.
We've seen it with the CDL debacle. If you can get a CDL and drive from New York to California and back,
well, Don, it's very easy to answer that. You print on it and it said not to be used as legal ID. You just put that on there, and you put it on there the same way it says a real ID for you and I to get into the airport, and you make sure people go licensed to drive, but not used for a license ED. Or you could put non-citizen. I would never be given these licenses, you know, and you wouldn't be given these licenses, but you know, and that's the reality, though they got them. But you just don't walk up and say, driver's valid driver's license, yes, but you print on that one that says there's no ID here, so I'm going to put on this not to be used as ID. That'll be one thing. And I just think you can go into this act, and if Democrats are really looking at any poll that 8 out of every 10 Americans wants ID, then they should be working something out. Sandra on WABC in New Jersey. Hey, Sandra.
Good morning, Brian. I love listening to you every day.
Thank you. I don't always
call in, but I'm here today. You know, I was thinking about Mandani, how he missed the Cardinal ceremony, learning that no other mayor ever missed it before. So that was hurtful. But then we look at Jessica Tisch. She appointed Cardinal Dolan as co-chief chaplain of the New York
yes.
Police Department, a welcome and an honor, showing respect. So there's the difference in leadership right here. And I just wanted to point that out.
And thank you, Sandra. What people around the country don't know is that in St. Patrick's Cathedral, and there's more Catholics here than any place else, 2.5 million, they did a transition of power to this now Cardinal Hicks, who's going to run things, the Archbishop. And this is the first New York City mayor. Doesn't matter. We've had Jewish mayors before, Bloomberg and Koch, who did not show up for the ceremony. For no reason. Disrespectful.
The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
And I have just as much respect for you as I do for the last white men who put on masks to terrorize communities of color. I have no respect for the inheritors of the Klan Hood and the slave patrol.
Do you know what other regimes in the 20th century required similar proof of citizenship?
This is the wrong type of question you should
be asking me. I'll tell you what the wrong type
but
of
actually,
thing
sir,
is.
Sir, it's my Holocaust
time.
Museum
reclaiming my time, sir.
If you want
reclaiming
to go see Nazis,
my time,
that's
Mr.
What it
Chairman.
Is. It's not the men and women of ICE that are out there doing it every day. So to say that the men and women of ICE are Gestapo's.
Mr. Chairman, I'm reclaiming my time. I would like my time back, please. Please give me another 15 seconds because he was unnecessarily speaking.
Yeah, they're speaking because you're supposed to be asking them questions. This is a little of the anarchy and the chaos and the circus atmosphere in Washington yesterday when ICE showed up. They don't talk about the 1.9 million that self-deported, the 630,000 that they've rounded up. They don't talk about how it relates to the unprecedented drop in almost all violent crimes across the country in all 50 states. So I wanted to give My guest right now, George P. Bush, the former land commissioner of Texas, the 28th. And I did ask him before we started, George, I said, do you want to go to Congress? And you said, no, absolutely not. Maybe this is the reason why. No one wants to get anything done there. They're trying to raise money by saying obscene things to each other.
Yeah, that's the only way they can get attention and, you know, for folks like us to talk about how laughable and how off base their viewpoints are. I mean, when you look at the mayor of Minnesota, of Minneapolis, for example, and the recent incidents that have unfolded there, I mean, the irresponsibility of local, county, and state officials to work with federal government and federal law enforcement is symptomatic of what we're seeing. Just a reckless disregard of the oath that they put their hand on the Bible on, saying that they will uphold the laws of our country and of our land. And that's why last November, people spoke very forcefully about the president's agenda as the number one issue to not only secure the southern border, which is important to countless Texans, but to communities, especially in sanctuary cities where they ignored federal law. This is symptomatic of what we're seeing on the left. There's very few people you can actually work with to implement some reforms that even ICE says that they would be open to tactically in terms of helping to operate in communities. But when you look at the facts, and you've unloaded a few there, we are still interdicting less than at the clip of the Obama administration. We've removed less, but yet when you hear this rhetoric from the far left, which now regretfully is in control of the Democratic Party, that's what Republicans have to deal with in the Congress to get good public policy forward.
It's crazy. And again, what you just said and how you just explained it shows why you shouldn't be in Washington, because you're not looking for sound bites. You're looking to actually answer my question. By the way, after this, I'll be taking phone calls. So Jerry, Alton, Danny, and Hank, Danny's over in Israel, so I'll get to you. But I want to spend this segment talking to you. First off, on the border, I have not been here since Trump took over. I only, the last time we talked, every time I saw you, it seemed to be getting worse. And even when Trump was cracking down, we still had a big problem to get Remain in Mexico to work, because there was a big surge and caravans were coming. And the question was, how long can you hold it out? And they don't want to build the wall. All of a sudden, a few months in, we have shut it down. Give me an idea, George Bush. What is it like at the border?
It's the difference between night and day. The morale, most importantly, of our Border Patrol could not be higher. You know, I do keep in touch with a lot of folks at the Border Patrol Council, and really good, honorable folks that were facing high rate of suicide, high rate of disembarking from a career in law enforcement. And it was really tragic and sad. And then, of course, the Texas, countless Texas DPS, right, that are state law enforcement officials under Governor's Operation Lone Star, Governor Greg Abbott's initiative to help secure the border during the Biden administration. They were torn away from their families to help secure the southern border.
Cost you a lot of money. Cost your state money.
Billions, which the governor and the lieutenant governor and our speaker, you know, have worked with the Trump administration to get some level of reimbursement. But it was in excess of $12 billion over the course of just those 4 years during the Biden days. And so Texas has spilled blood, treasure, and sweat to make sure that our border is safe. But it's night and day. So encounters are down over 90%. The gotaway figures are down over 90% as well. You know, the construction of the border wall continues at the state level, federal level, obviously.
You guys are building your own wall still, too?
We did. So I initiated that when I was land commissioner. And that was one of my proudest moments of public service, was knowing, look, Biden at the time was working on reappropriating the dollars which were initially allocated for the first component of Trump's vision for southern border wall. And so we took state resources on state lands in one of the most highly trafficked areas of Texas, in the Rio Grande City area, which is now down to, you know, very few encounters, just in 2025 figures alone. And so those projects continue. And now there's a collaborative work environment.
So, George, does it blow you away? Does it blow you away that they stopped? We thought they couldn't get in, but we thought people were going to try. So what has happened? Is it pressure on the Central American nations, along with pressure on Mexico, that on their southern border that stopped it? I mean, one of the first things that happened, El Salvador's president came to meet. We've made it obvious we needed better relations with Honduras. Now, whether Sheinbaum and Trump are constantly sparring, but I think there's a mutual respect there. Is that the key to this, the pressure there?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of pieces of credit that go around. Yes, the Mexican government, Trump levering, you know, his tariff discussions with the upcoming USMCA, the so-called NAFTA 2.0 that is supposed to be renegotiated this year, holds a very heavy weight over the head of the Mexican government. And Sheinbaum, as part of that agreement, understands the national security component of economic trade with the United States. And so she does not uphold her end of the bargain. Though today's incident and the information that's coming out in El Paso could work against her,
Could you give me an idea? I am so confused by this. We heard the El Paso airport was going to be closed for 10 days. And then as I'm coming up here from Fox and Friends to do the radio show, it is reopened. What's going on?
So I did get in touch with some folks in Department of Homeland Security in El Paso, and you know, this is a UAV breach of American airspace. People forget, with Fort Bliss in El Paso, you have the largest national airspace in North America, in the lower 48.
But isn't it a private air? Isn't it a public airport?
It is a public airport.
Commercial airport.
So yeah, it's a commercial airport, but there's also military airspace in that area as well. I do want to give your audience a little bit of context, in the sense that the Jalisco drug cartel, which is notoriously active. There's three major ones that operate in the El Paso area. By the way, Ciudad Juarez, which is right across the border from El Paso, is it's just a major thoroughfare from human trafficking to drug trafficking, particularly during the Biden days. But just this past week, the head of the Jalisco drug cartel put a hit on any member of Border Patrol in operation, authorizing them to shoot.
Did I know that? That was public. Publicly put
out? That was publicly put out. Just verified that. That was 2 days. Didn't get a lot of news. We'll see which cartel put out the UAVs. I'm sure
it came from Mexico.
Came from Mexican side, breaching our airspace. And so, you know, as somebody who did operate in Afghanistan, with special operations as an intelligence officer, UAVs, you could see even back during those days, was going to be, and we've seen this play out in Ukraine and Russia, an element of modern warfare. And now the cartels, you know, there's, again, being in Texas, we see this a little bit closer. The amount of ammunition that they have, the material that they have, and now the utilization of automated drones is problematic, and it's something that our national security infrastructure is going to have to anticipate in the years to come.
What changed in one day or 3 hours? How did you go from 10-day shutdown? And we can only speculate.
Yeah. Well, as we walked in, the only statement from Department of War is that the threat was mitigated and neutralized, and that it was deemed to be now safe for civilian air traffic. But, you know, again, more will come out. I'm sure there's developing news as we speak right now on this issue.
George P. Bush is our guest, and we just have a few more minutes. But just on this in particular, the President of the United States made it clear, we know fentanyl is coming from Mexico. We know the precursors are coming from China. He knows, he's publicly said the problem is the cartels. And he's actually said, I told Sheinbaum, if you want me to hit them, I'll hit them. They're more powerful than you. You're susceptible to them. She vehemently denies that they're more powerful than her. But do you see a time, and judging by what the president's already done in Venezuela, that we'll have to take action there? And what would that be like? Because they're an ally, right? Taking out a group, a gang, cartel in Mexico.
Well, we should take a step back because Mexico, you know, is a failed narco state. The lack of control is not only noticeable in another northern border states among the cartels that are operating for real estate, if you will. It's a real estate play to gain access to the number one demand market for drugs, for human and sex trafficking. So that's the bottom line. And she's lost control over those cartels. And so this is going to be a serious problem for our country moving forward. Again, tying national security with the economic ties that we hope to have. But unless they uphold their, meaning the government, uphold their end of the bargain, this will continue to be a lawless situation. But yes, it's highly foreseeable that there's some sort of covert action that's at play here. Just a few weeks ago.
It's dangerous. It'll be dangerous.
It'll be dangerous, not only for business, but for tourists. But, you know, just going back to the drug cartel situation, 27, and the Mexicans are trying, you know, to be a part of this effort by releasing 27 members of this drug cartel to authorities in El Paso to begin the interdiction and, adjudication process there. So there's more to come there.
What is the benefit of us taking imprisoned, criminal Mexican prisoners and bringing them here? Intelligence reasons?
Intelligence gathering. Absolutely.
Hey, how you doing? How would you like your accommodations to be, better or worse?
Exactly.
Right? And that's how you do it?
Yes.
So pressure
and
them.
And that's how we caught El Mayo, who is a major drug, part of the Sinaloa cartel, which your audience may know of Chapman Guzman, who El Chapo, as he's known. And so getting Mayo, we were able to leverage folks that were involved in his network and in recovering that intelligence to capture him and convince him to come to El Paso, as it turns out, as part of a covert operation.
There's two things that the president has in his midst that I know you and your family have talked about forever. We've had a problem with Cuba since the 60s, right? 50s. And we've had a problem with Iran since 1979. How we're dealing with it, what's up, what's down. You pick up a newspaper, you watch the news, and now 24 hours, and you get your newspaper online. You could be sure there'll be a story about Iran doing something to do with terror in Cuba, spreading communism. After all, Castro mentored Chavez. He mentored Ortega. They continue to get money from Soviet Union, now Russia, now China. Any enemy of ours is a friend of Cuba's. Now you have Iran on the ropes and Cuba on the ropes. And everyone's right. Oh, you see column after column. This is the moment that Cuba can be squeezed. We told Mexico no more oil in there. Where's this going? First Cuba, where's that going?
Well, I'm glad you pointed that out, because we have told the Mexicans, you're no mas, you're not selling any more oil to Cuba.
We stopped Venezuela, obviously.
And so economically, this is leveraging, and this is where the Donroe Doctrine is effective, is by leveraging economic tools that are at our disposal, not only here, but other parts of the world, to advance U.S. Foreign interests. And so Secretary Rubio deserves a lot of credit. He's about as close to the issues
Tremendous.
As somebody you can find that's working in the federal government. But I think it's a matter of time before the Cubans relent, and then they realize that they're going to have to create a similar situation to what we're seeing in Venezuela, where there's almost like a power-sharing agreement, not necessarily a nation build, because I think those days are behind us as a country.
Can't do it.
But working with the existing infrastructure, but abiding by U.S. interests.
But with those leaders, those leaders maybe take the one pass, you know, get a one-way pass to Qatar or wherever. You remember Aristide in Haiti? You know, we said, okay, you can leave now. You can live a cushy life, or you could not live anymore. So Maduro's now in Brooklyn. They see that. And do you think that, as long as there's a Castro there and the brother's still there, and I don't know who the other leader is, do you think the Cuban people can really get underneath, out from underneath them? Or do they have to be jettisoned?
Well, I think it's a little bit different than, say, for example, in the streets of Iran, where we've seen massive
True.
Amounts of protests and an estimate of over 20,000 people that have lost their lives in expressing their free will.
Shot their hospital beds, too.
Which is unbelievable and horrific, and really not getting as many news headlines as you would think. But in Cuba, I think it's going to be a slow transition with the existing infrastructure and, I guess you can call them, a Politburo, of a council of elderly leaders that orchestrate this transition to a modern
market
economy. And eventually transition, hopefully, to free and fair elections. And again, freedom of expression, release of political prisoners, which have been held for decades, that have U.S. interests and have advocated for these constitutional beliefs.
You know, there's opportunities. This is a window of opportunity. The president is not shy about taking it, but he's very concerned, and it's admirable, of casualties. And that's his one thing. Let's talk about Texas Senate race. We have a situation where the attorney general wants to take John Cornyn's spot, and Wesley Hunt wants to take John Cornyn's spot. You ran against him. You say Cornyn's trailing by about 6 points?
There's a recent poll that shows him down, but in the top two. And so to remind your audience, Texas does have a runoff. So unless you don't get a majority, we move to a runoff in the May timeframe. And so it's highly likely to be a drawn-out conflict between Cornyn and Paxton. You know, as a Republican, as chairman of Restore Trust PAC, I'm focused on helping whoever that nominee is against the next Beto O'Rourke, which is likely to occur with Jasmine Crockett and James Tallarico on the other side.
Because you can't sacrifice the seat.
Can't sacrifice the seat, because some data shows us down in four Senate races right now across the country. And we absolutely have to keep the majority in the Senate to help out the president for the last 2 years of his term.
Absolutely. And I know you're not the biggest Ken Paxton fan. That's why I ran against him. Do you think that it's going to be harder for him in the general than Cornyn, conventional wisdom? Do you agree with that?
Well, the data, don't take it from me, take it from the data. It shows him underwater against Tallarico and Jasmine Crockett, who are the Democratic front runners. And so whereas against Cornyn or Hunt, we would win, you know, just hands down. So I think this, as Republicans step into the ballot box, you have to weigh that, among other things. And we'll see where the president weighs in if he decides to endorse in the race.
George P. Bush, I know for now you're taking a pause, but my hope for the country is that you get back in at some point when your kids get a little older and you can do so a little bit of traveling. But you got the military background. You have actually, as land commissioner, extremely successful. And then you got the legal background. You're a lawyer. So you're a triple threat, at least. George P. Bush, great to see you.
Great to be back with you.
All right, your phone call's next.
Learning something new every day on The Brian Kilmeade Show. He's so busy, he'll make your head spin. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Thanks so much for listening. By the way, I'm going to be in Fort Myers on Saturday, February 14th. There's only a few tickets left. I want to see you in person. Go to BrianKilmeade.com. It's going to be streamed on Fox Nation if you're not in the area. Which, Danny, you're in Israel, so you're not going to be able to go. What's on your mind?
Hi, Brian. How are you doing?
Good.
Obviously, I wanted to touch base with the issue of Iran. And I think that the talks with the Iranians might be going in the wrong direction, Brian. And why? Why I'm saying that? Because even considering to give up the issue of the ballistic missiles is a wrong proceeding. I think so. And it is not an Israeli issue, Brian. Brian, we know that they are developing intercontinental missiles. And I recall you that Israel and Iran are in the same continent. So actually, those missiles are not being developed for the Middle East. Brian, the only language they understand, the Ayatollahs, is the force and power. So, Brian, let's shoot and stop talking.
Your prime minister can be very persuasive, and hopefully he will be in Mar-a-Lago, and, excuse me, in Washington today. Jerry, real quick in Georgia. Jerry, what's on your mind? Hey, Jerry, you're in Georgia. Alton, you're in North Carolina. Alton. Tell me the Epstein case.
No, I'm just talking about the Nancy Guthrie case, man. I mean, I don't know if they're asking you guys or how it works, but I mean, I know everybody keeps saying on the news that this guy ain't real smart, you know, and it's going on 11 days and nobody's really found anything but this video.
I know the video shows the guy stumbling along. Is it the same people with Bitcoin? Are they related or is it a hoax?
News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hi everyone, Brian Kilmeade. Thanks so much for listening. I come to you from Midtown Manhattan or around the country, around the world. And I'm just a little off balance because this just came out. TMZ has received another note demanding one Bitcoin, demanding Bitcoin to name alleged abductor of Nancy Guthrie, demanding one Bitcoin. TMZ is receiving a new note related to the Guthrie case, and they don't know what they can actually say forward. Now, I think we're on two tracks. Last night, we saw what happened in the Guthrie case. We saw the video emerge, and we saw the guy emerge with some still pictures and try to rip it and actually successfully rip a Nest camera right off a house. And then they think they have the guy. They pulled somebody over related to the guy. He ended up not being the guy. And we haven't seen much today, but we just found out that TMZ just got another note. Now, it looks like Bitcoin hasn't been confirmed yet, but the cryptocurrency wallet, the Bitcoin, got $300 put into it at least yesterday. They wanted $6 million. And now, according to another source that tells TMZ, they say we got another letter and they want more money. Are these two separate paths? I mean, you saw that guy plotting around with the thick gloves, the backpack, the mask, leaving his eyes open in order to get scanned or facially scanned. Something's going to break today. I just don't know. We're just watching David Swecker, former assistant FBI director, come out and say, I don't believe these notes are real. I don't think there's anything to do with it. I think it's from outside the country. This hour, I'm going to be joined by Daniel Turner. He is the founder of Energy Advocacy, the power of the future. He's going to be with us talking about what we're doing with oil and gas and the president taking on Barack Obama's Clean Air Act. And Jennifer Griffin is standing by, Fox News' national security correspondent. So before we get to Jennifer, let's get to the big three.
Number three.
Well, how do you think Judgment Day will work for you with so much blood on your hands?
I'm not going to entertain that question.
Oh, okay, of course not. Do you think you're going to hell, Mr. Lyons?
I'm not
going to
entertain.
Of course not.
Embarrassing and aggravating. Dems continue to disparage and attack ICE and anyone associated with them while not acknowledging that thousands of criminals have been taken off the streets. 1.9 million have self-deported. 630,000 have been brought up. And these numbers don't even approach the numbers that Barack Obama did.
Number two.
The key at the end of the day is no nuclear enrichment, no more ballistic missile or drone activity, and no more money going to their proxies. And Iran's never going to agree to that, and that's why I think the president needs to take his moment and make this a legacy-defining moment.
Yeah, historic opportunity. I 100% agree with the former governor of South Carolina and ambassador to the UN. Countdown to takedown. My hope is we take the Iran government out as they begin to assassinate would-be protesters who are in the hospital. 207 have already been killed. Who are also associated with protests, at least they claim. That's how desperate Iran is to hold on to power. We're the only one that could wake them up. And that's why Netanyahu and the president are meeting right now.
Number one.
There's a lot with that video, for sure. There's a lot of identifying features that people are going to key on. The backpack, his clothes, his walk. So you want this video out there because that's how this is going to move forward.
Well, we'll see. It is out there. And that is one of these investigators talking about the Guthrie case. You have a major break and now you have a new letter. And I want to put that. We'll keep you up to date on what happens as more revelations come out about the TMZ latest hostage note. But I want to bring in Jennifer Griffin now. Jennifer, welcome back.
Thank you, Brian.
So, Jennifer, if you were inside the meeting between the Prime Minister of Israel and the President of the United States, I sense this is very substantive. What do you think they're just talking about?
Well, I think it's very clear. Let's look at a few things that have happened this morning. First of all, Prime Minister Netanyahu met with Secretary of State Marco Rubio this morning. He signed on to the Board of Peace in Gaza. That's something that Israel has not really wanted to be involved with because they didn't like the members that were being included, Saudi Arabia, Pakistan. Turkey. They had issues with the groups that were involved, and they were worried they were going to get pushed into something in Gaza that they don't want to agree to from a security standpoint. So that is showing that Prime Minister Netanyahu is under some pressure from the U.S. government. He met with Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner, who obviously are taking the lead on not only Gaza, but also other significant talks right now. In terms of Iran, I thought it was notable that Vice President J.D. Vance said today, put out a statement today, that if the Iranian people choose to overthrow their government, then that's one thing, but it will be up to the Iranian people. That is definitely the White House taking a step back from regime change talk in terms of Iran. What we do know is that the talks that took place between the Iranian sides that included Witkoff, Jared Kushner, and the head of CENTCOM, they were face-to-face. I was able to report that last week. And they were only discussing the nuclear program. And we also heard from foreign minister as soon as he got back from those talks that Iran, their hardline stance in those talks is that they will continue to have the right to enrich uranium. That's a non-starter for the U.S. and Israel. Israel is here because they also are mostly concerned that the U.S. is not going to deal with the ballistic missile program. That if that's not even part of these negotiations, Israel still feels that they are in the direct line of sight for Iran's ballistic missiles, which have grown tremendously. The stockpiles have grown tremendously since last summer. And that is why I think that Prime Minister Netanyahu is here today meeting with the president.
Here's what General Keane said about that meeting. Cut 16.
The meeting between these two leaders is certainly, it's quite amazing. President Trump's been in power for 13 months, and this is his seventh meeting with Prime Minister Netanyahu. You got to look at what he is. He's really a wartime commander, and President Trump certainly is full throttle in support of this wartime commander because obviously they're our closest ally in the Middle East, and he is fighting Iran and its proxies trying to literally destroy the state of Israel. This is what this has been about.
So they're probably going to have a meeting. Number one, were you surprised, Jennifer Griffin, that about 3 weeks ago when the president said to the protesters, "I got you back," Prime Minister Netanyahu came out and basically said, "We're not ready"?
I was not surprised because most of the U.S. Central Command assets had been pulled out of the Middle East, significant assets like the aircraft carrier, to be sent to Venezuela. They were in the Caribbean. A lot of the air, the missile defense that would protect not only Israel, but also U.S. bases across the Middle East were not in position. There were concerns about the number of interceptors that were pre-positioned. They had blown through a lot of those for the THAAD and other defensive missile systems. So what we've seen now in the last month is a massive buildup of forces in the Middle East that would provide protection not only for Israel, but also for U.S. bases, which are very, very vulnerable, particularly to if you look at Bahrain and along the Gulf side of things where the U.S. has a number of bases. Those are very vulnerable to not only Iranian missiles, but also their Navy. Their Navy was not disabled last summer, and they have a very significant ability to disrupt the Strait of Hormuz. So what we're seeing is a massive buildup, but we also see a kind of buying of time. And it seems like the president wanted to buy time by positioning the aircraft carrier, by now talking about maybe sending a second aircraft carrier. That would delay things by another 2 weeks. And so I think the president genuinely wants to see if he can make gains in negotiations. I don't think he wants to have to militarily act, but he also has told CENTCOM to be ready, and CENTCOM has told him that they needed a little more time to get everything positioned. Mm-hmm. That buildup is almost complete, I would say, but there are a number of things happening in the region that I think would delay the timing of any sort of strike. So I don't believe there will be a strike tonight, for instance. First of all, there would never be a strike while the Israeli Prime Minister is visiting the U.S. Yeah. inside the U.S. He's not going back till Friday. You also still have a very sensitive mission taking place in Syria, where the U.S. military is moving up to 7,000 ISIS prisoners. About half of that, I'm told, has already taken place, moving them to Iraq because of the instability in Syria. There is no way that the U.S. is going to jeopardize troops on the ground and that mission by starting a second front with Iran at this moment in time. So that's not complete. You also have the Olympics going on. And we saw, you know, years ago when, 4 years ago when Putin invaded Ukraine, countries tend not to do big military strikes while the Olympics are going on.
Well, that's interesting. So what do you think we would target? And would, are there people in Iran, do you think, that we have located that we might be able to work with?
Well, I am quite certain there's been a covert operations down, you know, across Iran going back to the December timeframe. If you listen to Scott Bessent, the Treasury Secretary, he testified to Congress that he believed that he believed that the reason that the protesters came out in December was because of some of the economic the maneuverings of basically crashing the dollar in Iran, making a shortage of dollars. So there was a run on banks, the failure of a bank then put people into the streets. He was basically taking credit for that financial and economic move in December that then saw those tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands of Iranians take to the streets. I would also point out today, Brian, that this is the anniversary of the revolution, and the regime itself is reporting that there are 23 million Iranians in the street supporting the revolution, supporting the regime. I don't have any confirmation of that, but certainly they have put a lot of pressure on people to come out and show that there's still support for the regime. So the president is in a very, very tricky position in terms of decision making. From a military standpoint, the question the military is asking is what comes next? What comes next? You can take out missile sites, but many of Iran's missile launchers are mobile. They have about 200 mobile missile launchers. Those are very difficult to target in real time. They can certainly take out the stockpiles. They can go back and try to hit some of the nuclear sites, but many of the three sites were basically destroyed. However, there's still this missing more than 900 pounds of highly enriched uranium that's not accounted for. That is going to require probably boots on the ground or inspectors to ever get to that. So these are they can carry out military strikes, but to what end? And what happens if you target the regime itself and it's overthrown? What comes next? There are people who can take the place of this regime. This is not a small, like, a pinpoint operation where you grab someone like Maduro and suddenly you control the government. You're talking about a Shia Muslim regime that there are layers of people who could still step in even if you took out the top leadership.
Jennifer Griffin, our guest. Jennifer, NATO, our vulnerability to Russia, the Germans are starting to step up, but I'm watching your report with Brett Baer last night. NATO is not ready to push back on the Russians, are they?
Well, it was really interesting. This war game that was carried out by the German newspaper, Die Welt, and had some very senior former NATO officials who were role playing the different response time. What they were looking at was the decision making by NATO members and whether Germany would send troops into Lithuania if Russia used as a cover humanitarian operation to move its troops into Kaliningrad, which you cross through Lithuania basically to get to Kaliningrad, which is a Russian territory, that would be a move that Russia could use to basically threaten Europe. But the decision-making time was slowed because of the chaotic nature of 32 NATO members having to decide if this was an Article 2 violation. And they really found that it was too slow and that that Europe and NATO was not prepared to react swiftly enough, particularly if the President of the United States expressed any concern about invoking Article 5 or slowed the process in any way. And that was what really came out of this war game. And it is a wake-up call to Europe. Also, we were also reporting, and this is significant, that Britain has released a defense. The defense industry in Britain only has 8-day supply of ammunition if there were a war in Europe. That is a huge wake-up call and should be a wake-up call for NATO.
So just real quick on Russia and Ukraine, Lavrov came out yesterday and says U.S.-Russian relations are going in the wrong direction, blamed us, the fact that the peace process, he says, has slowed down, blamed us for the fact that it's slowed down. I find that very interesting.
This is the trick that the Russians always pull, and this is the problem with the Iranians and the Russians. They go into open-ended negotiations because they want to buy time. They play games. They are the most frustrating partners to have to try and negotiate with. There is no way that the Russians or the Iranians are going to negotiate an end to either their occupation of a country like Ukraine or the end of their regime. So these negotiations, they need to be very finite. They need to be specific about what and not open-ended, because that is the game that that countries like Russia and Iran play. And right now, it's not clear. I mean, there's no indication that Putin is ready to stop his war in Ukraine.
Even though he's losing about 35,000 soldiers a month.
He's not afraid of that. I mean, that's what we can never understand, that autocratic regimes, there is no depth to the amount of loss that they, I mean, go back to World War II, look at how many people Russia lost. We don't understand, and they are recruiting people from Africa, they're recruiting people from North Korea. Yes, it's hard on them. The only thing that's really hard on Russia is to lose their petrodollars. And so the targeting, the best thing that the administration is doing right now is targeting the ghost shadow fleet of oil tankers that are basically helping Iran and Russia avoid sanctions. You tighten that up and you really shut down the economy and the money flowing into Russia. That's the only way to stop this war.
Jennifer, so much going on, and we'll see what happens with Iran. I get the sense the president's going to be taking action. Jennifer Griffin, thanks so much.
Thank you, Brian.
You got it. Of course, big meeting today. We'll bring you the latest. Bottom of the hour is Daniel Turner. We'll talk energy. But next, we'll give you some highlights. And I'll give you an idea of what's going on with Pam Bondi on Capitol Hill talking Epstein files. What could go wrong?
Where big stories meet bigger conversations. Stay informed and energized with the Brian Kilmeade Show. From his mouth to your ears, it's Brian Kilmeade.
So clashing going on between Pam Bondi on Capitol Hill and everyone talking about the Epstein files and who's in there and the million pages and I want a million more. And we're also trying to avoid what I think is going to be a story that I just hate reporting on and you hate hearing it. Another embarrassing government shutdown of the DHS. And as Senator Josh Hawley just said, you know, you shut down DHS because you don't like ICE. ICE is fully funded. So you're going to be hurting FEMA. You're going to be hurting TSA. You're going to be hurting the air traffic controllers. I mean, what are you doing? Because you want to act tough to your party, to your base, when you have an election 9 months away. It's just crazy. And it's embarrassing. And it hurts everybody. You can't budget. You can't think about individuals. If you work at DHS, you know, maybe low-end $80,000 a year, high-end $250,000 a year, which means after taxes, you're basically, if you live a modest living, you can't afford to miss a paycheck. You're going to do this again? Again. So I just find it unbelievable. And I also find it a little unbelievable that we're going to be spending so much time on two things that don't really matter. Number one, the Epstein files. It only matters to those people that went through the hellacious situation as young women on that island with a guy that no one seemed to understand is evil until he ended up dying. When we come back, Daniel Turner, we'll talk about energy. We also will talk about things that really matter to you, too.
A talk show that's real. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
They're critics because President Trump's economic policies are working, whether it's energy dominance, which is making sure that we've got prosperity at home and peace abroad, or whether it's his tariffs. Everything that they were concerned about that they thought was going to be an issue has turned out to not be. President Trump right again on economic policy. And again, for Americans, that means lower gas prices. When you have lower energy prices, it lowers the price of the clothes on your back, the food on your table, how you heat your home, the gas in your car. Energy prices are a component of anything, and he's driven those down tremendously.
And right now, yeah, no one doubts that, even though, believe it or not, the price has not gone down in California, because as energy gone down, they keep adding in additional taxes. So the number doesn't move. Scary. Daniel Turner, founder of the Energy Advocacy Group, Power the Future, is back in studio with us. Daniel, your thoughts about the president's doing on energy and what he's going to announce at the end of the week, which he actually did yesterday.
Well, I thought what the Secretary Burgum said is so important, right? Energy is everything. It's the price of everything, all food, all goods, all things that are transported, manufactured. So lowering energy prices will lower prices on everything. What the president's going to announce in a couple days is the repeal of the endangerment finding from the Obama era. It's wonky and nerdy, but if you're in this space, it is really exciting. Endangerment finding is the ultimate weaponization of government. Right. You have to go back to 2009, peak Obama popularity. Right. This was the second coming. They had veto proof majorities in the House and Senate, super majorities. Right. Republicans were dead in Capitol Hill. And even that Democrat Party was unwilling to pass legislation in the climate space.
It's all climate. It's an emergency, climate emergency. We're going to put massive regulations in.
Yep.
How much do they cost the government, do you think?
Trillions of dollars over the years. And it wasn't done through your legislator, right? Brian Kilmeade didn't get a chance to weigh in via the person he sent to Congress or the Senate. So they just said, you know what, we're never going to get this done. We're going to give this power to the EPA, and the EPA will regulate. You know, questions that we should have real good conversations on. What is pollution? Right. Let's have a conversation. What is a greenhouse gas? If the EPA administrator is like, you know what? I think a new greenhouse gas is carbon dioxide, and I think the parts per million should be X. That's now the law of the land. So you're a company, and now you have to recalibrate to hit the new EPA rule. And the next EPA administrator is like, you know what? I think this is now a greenhouse gas, and this is the part. So no one knew what the hell the truth was. No one knew what the rules were because they were total whim of a bunch of bureaucrats.
So what changes now? Lee Zeldin's going to be in control, and it's all repealed.
It's repealed, so it's not really doing anything as much as undoing.
It was never passed through Congress.
Never.
So it was an executive order.
It was an executive order that gave the government this authority. Now, if you are on the other side and you're like, we need these rules, we need these crazy environmental rules, fine. Propose a law, right? Get your legislator. I said this the other day. Chuck Schumer has been tweeting about it and how angry he is. Senator Schumer, you're the Senate Minority Leader. You can draft legislation right now that puts back in place all of this. But he's not going to, because he'll get crushed at the polls.
Why?
Right. Well, because no one wants to have a burdensome regulation on energy. No one wants to see the real driving cost of why electricity is so expensive.
And he's making everybody revisit it.
Yes.
Because we forgot about it.
And that's why they did. They hid it in the bureaucracy, right? Everyone can just point fingers and be like, oh my gosh, energy prices. It's Trump's fault. It's Putin's fault, right? It's his invasion of Russia. You can always find a scapegoat. But a lot of the high cost is baked into these bureaucracies. And it's the same on education, right? It's the same on healthcare. All of these regulatory things that are controlled by a bunch of unelected bureaucrats. Getting rid of all of that is great.
So right now, but there was a climate mania where people would have been going crazy. Do you think people are sobering up to, we got to be responsible, but we can't be suicidal?
Yeah.
Are people getting that now?
I think the cold helps quite a bit. Right. Like no one protests climate change when there's still a foot of snow outside and it's 9 and 10 degrees. Just the other day I was out walking and I'm like, wow, it's really nice. And it was like 18 degrees. I was like, that's how cold it's been for so long.
Yeah.
But wait for the summer. I wrote an op-ed not long ago, and I told people, get ready for the summer. Because in the summer, it's going to be 97. It's hot. People are bothered when it's hot.
They say the Earth is getting hotter than we thought. That's according to the Washington Post.
Yeah.
But they think that they don't know what's next. They finally admit they don't know.
No. And all these numbers, hotter than what? Hotter than what it's been the last 4 billion years? Hotter than what it's been since Daniel Gabriel Fahrenheit? I should probably pronounce it in the French way. Gabriel Fahrenheit. When he invented the reliable thermometer in the 1680s, right? So hotter than what? Like, all of these measures are a little bit arbitrary, but the Washington Post will just come out and be like, it's hotter than it's supposed to be. What's the core temp? What should be the average temperature of the Earth? That's a silly question.
Do you think, and by the way, we're talking to Daniel Turner, founder of Energy Advocacy Group, Power the Future. So what has this administration done? I know they're helping to reinvigorate coal.
Yeah.
We know they're doing the best they can on drilling, but the way the math works, if it's over $50 a barrel, is that it? They stop making money, so then they stop drilling. So when the dollar figure reaches a certain level, they'll stop drilling because they can't make a profit.
They will, and that is just the way the free markets work. And so the president will give the oil and gas industry the permissions necessary to do its job. And if they overdrill and overproduce, and we have more product and the price tanks, which is where we were heading, well, then they'll stop drilling, and then eventually the prices will catch back up, and it will be expensive, and there will be enough money that they'll start drilling again. But keep the government out of it, right? Keep the government out of that supply and demand equation. Just give the industry the tools to do its job, and the free markets are always going to have some fluctuation.
And I noticed, too, when it comes to the electric car, it looks like they're taking a huge loss because no one is buying electric vehicles anymore. That was the legacy of Joe Biden. He was so proud of that. I think you get $10,000. But now Ford says they're basically stopping it. They took a huge hit because they just had to walk away from, the Lightning.
Mike,
F-150 Lightning.
Mike, a colleague has an article today in Real Clear, Larry Behrens, and he talks about how this is the first Super Bowl where there were no EV commercials in like 6 or 7 years.
Yeah.
No EV commercials whatsoever. Why? Because there's no demand for it. I'm not anti-EV. Drive whatever vehicle you want. But why was the government forcing people to get them by market manipulation, by either punishing the fossil fuel industry, making gas so expensive? Remember, Pete Buttigieg would laugh. Oh, if you had an EV, you wouldn't be paying these high gas prices. Like, they were making fun of people who had combustion engines, and then they were incentivizing the EV. Get the government out of the damn situation. Buy whatever vehicle you want.
And by the way, he's the author of The Lack of Terminals. He had the infrastructure bill that gave him billions. I think by the time he left, he only built 25 terminals. It was supposed to make driving anywhere in this country easy if you're an electric car owner.
In that famous interview, and he said that it had been $8 billion, and he wasn't sure if they had built 7 or 8. And I remember laughing, thinking like 7 or 8, those aren't hard to quantify. Right? Like, is it 7 or is it 8? Big boy, like, those are big boy numbers. And he didn't know, 7 or 8. And the billions of dollars, where did it go? And that's kind of the legacy of the whole Biden green agenda. Billions spent, no one knows what
so
was
so let's
done.
Talk about how it relates to Russia buying selling discount oil to China And to India. India said, we'll start buying it from you now, natural gas and oil. Do you think they'll execute that way? And are we capable of supplying them?
I think we are. And I think they have to execute that way. And I think the president is using oil as leverage around the world for good. The sanctions back on Iran, what he's done in Venezuela, and try to force Russia from not having customers. That's the best way to bring about world peace.
How about Cuba?
Yeah.
Stop Mexico from selling oil and gas to Cuba.
And if bad guys don't have oil and they don't have money and power, they stop fighting wars. And then we're not sending a bunch of farm boys from Iowa to die on overseas battlefield because the bad guys never got rich and powerful to begin with.
And could you tell me, where is diesel right now? And why does it seem to be slower to come down than gas?
It's just a pure volume game, right? When you refine one barrel of oil, a small percentage of it goes to diesel. The vast majority goes to gas. The solution to more diesel is more refineries. That's the solution to a lot of problems. We need to build more refineries desperately in this country.
So we are now really in control of Venezuela's oil. How has that affected everything? And when you talk about the condition of their oil and gas fields, how would you describe it?
It would probably be like dial-up internet, right? Like, it works, but it's 20-30 years in the back and in retrograde, and it needs a lot of updating. That is better than starting from scratch, right? Like drilled wells that just need better infrastructure, better maintenance is a lot better starting point than no wells whatsoever.
Has it affected anything in the global market?
Really hasn't. I mean, I watched that happen. Remember, I think it happened on a Saturday morning, right? Like we all woke up and that had happened on Friday night, and I totally anticipated. I did a Fox show that I said, I'm curious to see oil markets open. Sunday, 6 p.m. is when oil markets open worldwide. I assumed they were going to go up $15, $20. Nothing. They were flat. Oil's up a little bit since then, but $4, $5, right? It's really been remarkable, the resiliency of the American energy industry, that the Venezuela engagement did nothing.
So now we start this rare earth vault in case of a rainy day. We got it for oil and we got it for gas, oil and gas. We know about that, the strategic oil reserve. That was what the president announced. But he's also been working hard with our allies from Pakistan to Australia on we're getting rare earth deals. After China said, we're going to hold him back for a while to kind of use some leverage against us. What progress are we making?
Slow, but steady and necessary. It was back in the 90s, the then premier of China, Deng Xiaoping, said the Middle East has oil, but we have rare earths. Right, they knew that rare earths were the wave of the future. The internet and the personal computer were just starting. They needed these trace elements of rare earths in their CPUs and in their chips. So they saw this future. They were way ahead of us in building out the rare earth and dominating this market.
Not only they have it, but they go to the Congo and take it over.
With slave labor.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they leave the country.
Little kids with spoons on mountains.
Leave the people at absolute ruins. Some warlord gets all of the money, right? They promise money and infrastructure for the community, but they don't. It's all stolen and awful conditions.
Well, China. We're making all these deals, and I think with Argentina too. They also have rare earth.
Yeah.
Do you see a year before we can supply our own here domestically and through our allies and trade partners?
I'd put it back to Venezuela that if the mine already exists and it's shifting who its customer is and making it more profitable, then a year is good. If we're starting from scratch, right, there are mines in America that we just got permits to open. It's going to take 7 or 8 years to get those mines
operational. Because we haven't been mining for a long time because of the environment.
Exactly. So we allow slave children in sub-Saharan Africa to do it, and we call ourselves green.
Yeah, I think it's absolutely crazy. But I think that's one thing the Secretary Burgum and Chris Wright is talking about, is getting the rare earth deals done immediately, get that vault set up. So if China turns around and says, we're holding it back, our military gets hurt, our computers are obviously hurt, the iPhones, communication, and they knew it.
Yeah.
And it seemed to have jarred the president.
It did. And you know what I love about this conversation is this is why I love this industry, because you hear this like, you're a shill for big oil, which is so boring and basic. Like oil, rare earths, metals, minerals, it is human dignity. It's world peace. It's slave children. It's better working conditions, right? These are really important issues of humanity and human flourishing that depend upon oil, gas, and coal and metals and minerals. And when you have someone like Joe Biden tinker in this space and produce chaos, all it does is diminish human dignity.
What's your view on windmills? Because there's a big battle in Long Island right now because they have these contracts done. I think they got them from Sweden. They're drilling them. The president said stop. Court says do it again. Your thoughts?
Oh, I don't know what part of Long Island is getting them. I assume it's not
water. Long Island Sound.
No, but is it East Hampton though? Like who's going to look out from their $40 million compound and see a windmill?
I think they all are. Montauk.
Or it's going to go on the North Shore.
Yeah.
Okay. I wouldn't be surprised if the president stops it because he hates windmills. He hates that they're foreign made.
No, Court reinvigorated it after they stopped it. But
I think he'll use national security protocols to shut it down. They're worried about radar. They're worried about first defense. They're worried about the military. And if you're a fisherman, and Long Island still has a lot of fishermen, and we're not far from lobster country, those people's lives are going to get destroyed.
Right.
Because they're not going to have any of the leased land to fish in, because it will all be cordoned off because of the windmills. They have very big footprints in the water, and you're not allowed to fish very close to them.
And I know in New Jersey, it was killing the dolphins, wasn't it?
And the whales. Remember, we used to hear about whales washing up all the time on the Atlantic shore. Why did that stop suddenly? You know, climate change? No, it stopped because we stopped the sonar drilling, the sonar buoys to put down wind turbines. So end the wind turbines. They're awful.
And Dan Turner, before we go, anything to keep in mind when it comes to energy? Give me a projection for 26.
We're headed in a good direction. I think oil is going to stay very, very stable. It's all going to be about affordability and electricity prices.
Yeah, then nobody can deny the prices are down when you go to put gas in your car. Daniel Turner, thanks so much.
Thanks, Brian.
When we come back, we'll find out if there's more to know.
you want. Truth you demand. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show. More to know. Sponsored by Prevagen. Prevagen, made for your brain.
That is true. So get your brain going. The stories that we haven't been able to do because we're doing so much Guthrie and Epstein and the politics. So let's find out if there's more to know. How about American Olympian skier Hunter Hess? Cannot wait to represent the Team USA. What a change in attitude from Sunday. The American skier appeared to backtrack on his mixed emotions about supporting the country. He heard some backlash after the president called him a total loser. He came out and said, "I love my country." He wrote that with an American emoji. There's so much that is great about America, but there are always things that could be better. No kidding. You don't have to set policy. Just ski. Next. A big study. A cup or two of coffee, two or three of coffee a day or tea a day helps keep dementia away. Boy, I'm okay with that. Drinking two or three cups of coffee a day reduces that, according to a study by the AMAA. The study looked at more than 130,000 people and found caffeinated coffee drinkers were 18% less likely to develop dementia. Researchers found out that one or two cups of tea have a similar effect, but decaffeinated coffee does not. So I assume the coffee people didn't sponsor this. Next, Super Bowl 26 posts the second best viewership ever. Bad Bunny's halftime show was 128 million. Of course, there were about 20 million that ended up going to the All-American show at the Turning Point. But they say they dipped a little bit overall from the 2025 Super Bowl because Fox did it. Next, Turning Point's All-American Halftime Show hit over 19 million views on YouTube as Turning Point reports 40 to 50 million tuned in across all platforms. Until You Can't, which is a song sung by, is Cody Johnson's song, and was sung by Kid Rock. It rocketed number one on iTunes. And, of course, Lee Bryce's song that he wrote and debuted just there was also a huge hit. Britney Spears is selling the rights to a music catalog. No, not to me, although I would love it. You know, songs like You Drive Me Crazy and Baby One More Time, Break the Ice and Circus have been sold to a group with a lot of money for the landmark deal in the ballpark of $200 million. It's kind of like what Justin Bieber signed. So congratulations to him. This is going to Tia Hara, cried to DMC. The problem is she's going to blow through all that. Have you talked to her lately? Have you seen her lately? It's not her fault. She's totally imbalanced, and she needs some help. And even with $200 million, it becomes scary to give people who need help a lot of money. Next, a 12-year-old Dallas student's four-year science project may have resulted in him becoming the youngest person to ever achieve nuclear fusion. I'm talking about my new best friend, Aiden McMillan. A Dallas Independent School District 7th grader said he worked on his ambitious project when he was just 8 and spent the first 2 years studying nuclear physics concept before building the first prototype. He said it took some work to ensure his mother was comfortable with his tinkering. Yes, that's a mom that says, "I don't have to give me your iPhone. You're spending too much time on Instagram." It seems like he was just trying to change the world. Make sure we don't actually give him up for draft picks to China. We need him to stay. And finally, Charlie Woods, outstanding golfer and son of Tiger Woods, has verbally committed to play golf for the Florida State Seminoles. A major milestone in junior golf story, a clear sign he's carving out a path that looks very different from his dad because his dad went to Stanford. I actually don't think it's that different from his dad because his dad went 1 year and then he went to played a few amateur tournaments, was great. I think he played on Long Island, too, at Shinnecock. While keeping his amateur status, then he went pro, and we all know what happened then. But Charlie looks to be a very good player, still growing.